Finished 2 Corinthians. We're going to be doing a few psalms, maybe 8 or 10 psalms actually, and then going and doing the book of Habakkuk. So I kind of know what the plan is. How many of you remember when we did Psalm 20? Anybody remember the occasion? It was back in April, I believe. Thanks a lot. I'm the one that was supposed to teach on that morning. Had a guest speaker that had a message that was more important than mine. There was a lot of interest in it, which is fine. And that was Steve Osborne. I remember when Steve was here. And this was our text for that morning. Psalm 20 and Psalm 21, most people think, pretty much go together. One is a prayer for God's help in an upcoming battle. And then that's Psalm 20. And then Psalm 21 is the people's praise and thanksgiving after the battle is over. So that kind of gives you an idea what happened. They were victorious. So they kind of go together. And so what I want us to do is read Psalm 20. The song we just got through singing is pretty much Psalms 20, or a great portion of it. You'll recognize some of the words and phrases as we go through it. So we're going to read Psalm 20 to begin with. Now picture in your mind a nation coming together, or a representative of the nation coming together. And because they know war is imminent, they know a battle is fixing to take place, and they come together to pray for the king, to pray for their army, to pray for, in particular, for the king as he leads them. And so they are there. And their petition is, and we're going to break it down into how it goes. In Psalm chapter 20, the first five verses is the people speaking to the king, who is responsible for leading them. Now, so notice what this says in the first five verses of Psalm 20, the people speaking to the king. And here's what they say. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob set you securely on high. May he send you help from the sanctuary and support you from Zion. May he remember all your meal offerings and find your burnt offering acceptable. May he grant you your heart's desire and fulfill all your counsel. We will sing for joy over your victory, and in the name of our God, we will set up banners. So those five verses are what the people are saying to the king. And then verse 6, I didn't finish reading verse 5, did I? And may the Lord fulfill all your petitions. Then in verse 6, it's the king speaking about God. He says, not speaking to God, but speaking about God. He says, now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. And then verses 7 and 8 are the people speaking to one another, where it says, some trust in chariots and some in horses. But we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stood upright. And then verse 9 is the people speaking to God when they say, save, O Lord, may the king answer us in the day we call. All right, so here is this meeting, a meeting of supplication and petition to God on the verge of war. Now, months later, weeks later, I don't know how long later, the war is over, victory has been obtained, and Psalm 21 is written. Now, first of all, I'd like to ask you this. What do you think it would be like for a nation? Can you envision the United States of America doing, as a whole, doing what we just read in verse 20? We can't imagine that. It just doesn't seem reasonable to think that would happen, does it? But what would it feel like if it did? Wouldn't that be a great feeling? It would. So the war is over. The soldiers are back home. The military is back home. And then we read Psalm 21, a prayer of thanksgiving for what God has done. So let's read Psalm 21. It says, O Lord, in thy strength the king will be glad, and in thy salvation how greatly he will rejoice. Thou hast given him his heart's desire, and thou hast not withheld the request of his lips, Selah. For thou dost meet him with blessings of good things. Thou dost set a crown of fine gold on his head. He asked life of thee, thou didst give it to him. Length of days forever and ever. His glory is great through thy salvation. Splendor and majesty thou dost place upon him. For thou dost make him most blessed forever. Thou dost make him joyful with gladness in thy presence. For the king trusts in the Lord, and through the loving kindness of the Most High he will not be shaken. Your hand will find out all your enemies. Your right hand will find out those who hate you. You will make them as a fiery oven in the time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them up in his wrath, and fire will devour them. Their offspring thou wilt destroy from the earth, and their descendants from among the sons of men. Though they intended evil against thee and devised a plot, they will not succeed. Thou wilt make them turn their back. Thou wilt aim with the bowstrings at their faces. Be thou exalted, O Lord, in thy strength. We will sing and praise thy power. So, two or three things I want us to think about just for a few minutes. The first one is this. The people have prayed for God to help them during the war. The nation as a whole has come together and asked for that. And God granted their request. God saved them from their enemy. At the end, when the king returns, and the military returns, the people are there, and there's celebration, there's praise, and they are thanking God for what he has done. Now, this thought came to my head. What would it be like to experience this second thing? What would it be like to envision the United States of America as a whole thanking God for saving us, for helping us in this country? Again, it's hard to imagine, but again, it would be a glorious, uplifting thing to see, wouldn't it? But here's the thought that I had. The king's success is my success. The king's loss is my loss. When the leaders of our country succeed, and I know we need to qualify that word, succeed at what? But when they succeed in righteous things, I benefit from that. You benefit from that. Righteousness lifts up a nation. When our leaders are successful in leading the country, and we mean success in a good way, and you know that, then we all benefit. When our leaders fail, when there is a loss in the leaders or in their decisions, and the country has a loss, then we experience loss. So I thought of the question, do I want my leaders to succeed or to fail? Let me get a little more specific. Do I want President Obama to succeed or to fail? Do y'all know the answer to my question for me? I would have to say, I wish he would fail. And it's not because I want to fail. It's not because I want to experience bad things. It's because I'm convinced his agenda is not one of righteousness. I'm convinced his agenda is one that if he were successful, I would experience failure in that way. So it's hard to be in a place where you want to pray for your leader's success if there's absolutely no reason to have hope in that. But at the same time, to know I'm going to experience loss if my leaders fail. Okay, in this chapter, chapter 21, the people are specific in their thanksgiving. And I want us to go through this because when you are thankful and when you express thanksgiving to God, I think it's good to be specific about it. Now, not just say, God, thank you for all your blessings. A general way. Of course, you know, that's better than nothing, I suppose. But be specific. God, thank you that you have placed food on my table. God, thank you that I have a good wife, that we have a good home. God, thank you that I have Christian friends that can walk through this life with me. God, thank you for health. Be specific about things that God has done. And let's notice what they say here in this chapter. The first one is this, and there's six of them, and the one in each of the first six verses. The first one is this, that they thanked God for giving them victory through God's strength. Not through the chariots and the men of war, as they said in the previous chapter, and we sung the song. Some trust in chariots, some trust in men of war, but our trust is in you, O God. And God, you've given us the victory, and we thank you that the victory came not through chariots and horses, but through your strength. How many of you saw the movie, is it Shenandoah? Jimmy Stewart, is that the Civil War? When he was the objector, wasn't going to get involved in the fight. Probably the thing I really enjoyed in that movie was him praying at the dinner table. Now, remember how he did that? Oh, God, we thank you. I don't know if he said thank you or not, but we cleared the field with our own hands. We plowed the thing. We sowed the seed. We reaped the harvest. We fixed the meal, we set it in front of us. We thank you for it. But the whole prayer was not giving God thanks, but telling God what all he had done. And that's sort of the opposite of what this first verse is saying. God, we thank you because in your strength, not because we had a mighty army, which you may have given us a mighty army, not because we were so wise military and our strategy was so great, even though you may have let it be, but because of your strength, because of your hand, the victory was obtained. God, we thank you. Verse 2, you've given him the desires of your heart. Back in chapter 20, he says, oh, may God give you the desires of your heart. And now he's thanking God that, God, you have given this, our king, the desires of his heart. What if God gave you the desires of your heart? First of all, there may be some of our desires that we don't need. We horribly don't need. There may be some desires of our heart that if we got them, we wouldn't want anybody else to know because they were evil desires. There may be desires of our heart. If we got the desires of our heart, it may be just full of material things and no spiritual benefit to us or anyone else at all. But to get the desires of your heart, God help the desires of our heart to be pleasing to Him. So that when we ask God, God, give me the desires of my heart, that that might be a righteous prayer. These two Psalms, they ask God, God, give the king the desires of his heart. And then they thank God. God, thank you. You gave the king the desires of his heart. Number three, the victory you gave was accompanied by many rich blessings associated with success. You know, when God blesses us, he may bless you with wisdom. Is that a blessing? To have wisdom? I would think so. And you know, there's a side benefit to being wise, usually. Usually, things go sort of smooth because you're wise and because things work out. Now, not always. God's hand is at work in our lives in a lot of different ways. But when the person who consistently makes wise decisions, usually his path is not as rough as the person who consistently makes foolish decisions. That's just the way it is. And usually God's blessing that comes with wise decisions sort of overflows, and it affects people around you. If you're a parent and you're a wise parent and you consistently make wise decisions, your children are going to reap the benefits of that through no fault of their own, just because they are in the vicinity of your blessings. And that's sort of what I think that he is saying here, not just with wisdom, but success. When God gave this nation victory in battle, there came blessings with it that had nothing to do with the military. It's just an overflow of things. And God, we honor that. We recognize that it comes from your hand. Number four, he says that the king asked for life. God, would you protect us? And God gave him not just life, but long life. Length of days, forever and ever. This is probably a messianic promise. David may have strictly been asking for life. Lord, I'm going to battle. Would you keep me safe? They may have strictly just been asking for his physical life in this war. But God gave them much more than that. God gave them the life. He spared his life, but God gave them more. God gave him a long life. God gave them a promise that his kingdom, that they were concerned about in that day and hour, would be established forever and forever. God's promise, God's answer to their prayer was so much more than they had ever anticipated. Number five, you have been given great glory, splendor, and majesty that you had not the ability to imagine. Sort of the same idea. You ask for this, and God gives you so much more. The glory of David's kingdom, the splendor and the majesty of it. And then the last one in verse 6, you blessed us with the joy of your presence. You made him joyful with gladness in his presence. It reminds me of the times that we see in I don't know if it's 1st, 2nd Kings or 1st, 2nd Samuel, of David and the coming back from battle and a parade and a procession and going through the streets, and David is joyful and dancing and singing. The king. All right? Almost, some would say, making a spectacle of himself with joy for what God has done. So, in your thanksgiving, be specific. If you can't think of specific things to be thankful for, you need to work on it, because you got some. You got plenty. I have plenty. Number 3, acknowledge the blessing of having a king who trusts in the Lord. And this verse 7 is sort of a transition verse. Notice what it says, for the king trusts in the Lord, and through the loving kindness of the Most High, he will not be shaken. Acknowledge the blessing of having a king who trusts in the Lord. When is the last time you had a national leaders in the presidency or the Senate or the Congress that we could say that man trusts in God? Perhaps there are some now, but they're in the minority, aren't they? It seems like the more that we know about them, the less we are inclined to have that kind of confidence. But to be able to say that our leaders trust in God. Number 4, thanksgiving not only acknowledges past victories, but anticipates future ones. In the psalm, the people are giving thanksgiving to God for what God has just done. But then in verses 8 to 12, they give God thanks for what they are anticipating will happen. Now, why are they anticipating that's going to happen? Because they've seen it in the past. When God gives us delivery, when God delivers us, when God gives us victory after victory after victory, we come to anticipate more. We've come to anticipate God doing it again. Now, by anticipating future ones, I don't mean, and I don't think the psalmist means, that we're going to speak something into existence. You know, I've heard people pray that way, and I know where they're coming from, and I just don't go there. Okay? I'm not going to say, I'm going to have my heart looked at this Thursday. I may have heart trouble, maybe not, I hope not. But I'm not going to say, God, I thank you for letting this stress test come out well. I thank you for not letting me have clogged arteries. I'm not going to speak it into existence. I can't do that. I don't know what God has in store. I don't know what the results will be. Right, so it's not when I have confidence that God is going to do something, either in my life or in, you know, whatever the situation may be. It's not because I'm going to make it happen. It's because I have seen God work in the past. I have seen God's hand enough that I believe he will bless. Notice what they say in these verses. These can get pretty gory if you've got a little bit of imagination. One writer makes the comment that you've got to allow for a little poetry here. Okay, poets get a lot of license to say things in unique ways. Perhaps the psalmist is that way. Verse 8, your hand will find out all your enemies. Your right hand will find out those who hate you. Now remember, we've talked in the past about Hebrew parallelism, where he makes two statements that have the same message. Now perhaps these two statements have the same message. They sure are similar, aren't they? Your hand will find out all your enemies. Your right hand will find out those who hate you. Two different statements that pretty well mean the same thing. You could make a distinction where the first one is sort of a general statement. Your hand will find out all your enemies. Your right hand, or the hand of your strength, will find out specifically those people who hate your guts. All right? Verse 9. You will make them as a fiery oven in the time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them up in his wrath, and fire will devour them. Verse 9, a picture of you found out your enemies, and it's going to be as if you threw them and devoured them in a fiery furnace. Pretty dramatic. Verse 10, their offspring thou will destroy from the earth, and their descendants from among the sons of men. Not only are you going to deliver us from them, not only are you going to destroy them, you're going to wipe out all of their descendants. Their name, their family will be gone from the earth. Verse 11, though they intended evil against you and devise a plot, they will not succeed. They can make all the plans they want to make. They can sit down and with their strategy try to figure it all out, how they're going to defeat us, but you will not let them succeed. You will make them turn their back. You will aim with your bowstrings at their faces. In other words, your aim will be sure. The aim of your weapons will be on target. Those are the victories that they anticipate seeing from God in the future. And then the last verse is sort of a summary of the whole thing. Be thou exalted, O Lord, in thy strength. We will sing and praise thy power. Thanksgiving ought to exalt God. Your thanksgiving ought not to be as Jimmy Stewart's in Shenandoah, but your thanksgiving ought to exalt God. I'm going to close with just a story. In 1897, Great Britain celebrated the 60th year of Queen Victoria's reign. Great Britain at that time was pretty much a military power in the late 1800s. Their navy was pretty spectacular, I believe. And their nation had had a lot of success. Their nation was strong, and they felt good about their nation, felt good about their ability to stand in the world. And Queen Victoria had reigned for 60 years, and so there was a celebration. All of the important people in Great Britain had come to London. Over 200 ships from their Royal Navy was gathered in the harbor and in the surrounding areas. It looked like an impressive place. Rudyard Kipling had been asked to compose a poem for the occasion. I'll read you his poem. This was written 1897, so it's over my head as far as being able to keep up with their thought. I have to think about it. And I anticipate you might too, so I'm going to read it slow and explain it as we go, okay? He says, God of our fathers, known of old, Lord of our far-flung battle line. In other words, the reach of Great Britain was far-flung. All that, their reach in the world was great. Lots of colonies Great Britain had all around the world. Powerful nation. Start over. God of our fathers, known of old, Lord of our far-flung battle line, beneath whose awful hand we hold. And awful doesn't mean terrible. Awful means full of awe. Beneath whose awful hand we hold dominion over palm and pine. Again, a reference to their far-reaching influence. Lord of hosts, be with us yet, lest we forget. Lest we forget. Far called, our navies melt away. In other words, as they go across the oceans into their horizons, it seems our ships gradually disappear, get smaller, they melt away into the horizon. Far called, our navies melt away. On dune and headland sinks the fire. They fire from the ships to the land. Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre. Judge of the nations, spare us yet. Lest we forget. Lest we forget. What a fitting line for a nation who has it all. What a fitting line for a nation who is experiencing the bounty of God's blessing. Rudyard Kipling's poem was not appreciated. Can you believe it? They chose someone else from that point on to be the poet laureate for Queen Victoria. Why is that? It wasn't politically correct. It gave the glory to someone other than Queen Victoria. It acknowledged that our existence and our blessings and our success had come from God, not from our own mighty hand. And they were not ready to admit that. This psalm, I think, is written on a national level. It seems to me that we're almost beyond that in our nation. But it can be applied in your personal life. It can be applied in this church body. It can be applied in your family unit. And it can be applied personally just with you. And I would start there. I think that's where we ought to start. We need to start, I need to start with thanksgiving to God personally for how God has touched me. And then Susan and me together. And then the picture gets bigger. Don't neglect being thankful. Let's pray. God, as I read this psalm, Lord, in a way I longed for something that I have never seen. I wondered what it would feel like to live in a nation that acknowledged you, that loved you, that took great delight in giving you glory and exalting your name. Father, we're not there. But Lord, would you help me not to worry about that, just worry about exalting you in my own heart, in my own life, in my own family. Being thankful, being grateful. There's enough there to keep me busy. Praising your name. Lord, I love you. I worship you.